This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Artemis Fowl, The Eternity Code by Owen Colfer, read for you by Nathaniel Parker. Prologue. Excerpt from Artemis Fowl's diary, Disc 2, encrypted. For the past 2 years, my business enterprises have thrived without parental interference. In this time, I have sold the pyramids to a Western businessman, forged and auctioned off the lost diaries of Leonardo da Vinci, and separated the fairy people from a large portion of their precious gold. But my freedom to plot is almost at an end. As I write, my father lies in a hospital bed in Helsinki, where he recovers after a 2-year imprisonment by the Russian mafia. He is still unconscious following his ordeal, but he will awaken soon and retake control of the Fowl finances. With two parents resident in Fowl Manor, it'll be impossible for me to conduct my various illegal ventures undetected. Previously, this would not have been a problem, as my father was a bigger crook than me, but Mother is determined that the Fowls are going straight. However, there is time for one last job, something that my mother would not approve of. I don't think the fairy folk would like it much either, so I shall not tell them. Part 1. Attack. Chapter 1. The Cube. Enfin, Knightsbridge, London. Artemis Fowl was almost content. His father would be discharged from Helsinki's University Hospital any day now. He himself was looking forward to a delicious lunch at Enfin, a London seafood restaurant, and his business contact should arrive any moment. All according to plan. His bodyguard, Butler, was not quite so relaxed, but then again, he was never truly at ease. One did not become one of the world's deadliest men by dropping one's guard. The giant Eurasian flitted between tables in the Knightsbridge bistro, positioning the usual security items and clearing exit routes. "Are you wearing the earplugs?" he asked his employer. Artemis sighed deeply. "Yes, Butler, though I hardly think we're in danger here. It's a perfectly legal business meeting in broad daylight, for heaven's sake." The earplugs were actually sonic filter sponges, cannibalized from fairy lower elements police helmets. Butler had obtained the helmets, along with a treasure trove of fairy technology, over a year previously, when one of Artemis's schemes pitted him against a fairy SWAT team. The sponges were grown in LEP labs and had tiny porous membranes that sealed automatically when decibel levels surpassed safety levels. "Maybe so, Artemis, but the thing about assassins is that they like to catch you unawares." "Perhaps," replied Artemis, perusing the menu's entree section, "but who could possibly have a motive to kill us?" Butler shot one of the half-dozen diners a fierce glare, just in case she was planning something. The woman must have been at least 80. "They may not be after us. Remember, John Spyro is a powerful man. He put a lot of companies out of business. We could be caught in a crossfire." Artemis nodded. As usual, Butler was right, which explained why they were both still alive. John Spyro, the American he was meeting, was just the kind of man to attract assassins' bullets. A successful IT billionaire with a shady past and alleged mob connections. Rumor had it that his company, Fission Chips, had made it to the top on the back of stolen research. Of course, nothing was ever proved. Not that Chicago's district attorney hadn't tried several times. A waitress wandered over, giving them a dazzling smile. "Hello there, young man. Would you like to see the children's menu?" A vein pulsed in Artemis's temple. "No, mademoiselle, I would not like to see the children's menu. I have no doubt the children's menu itself tastes better than the meals on it. I would like to order a la carte, or don't you serve fish to minors?" The waitress's smile shrank by a couple of molars. Artemis's vocabulary had that effect on most people. Butler rolled his eyes, and Artemis wondered who would want to kill him. Most of the waiters and tailors in Europe, for a start.
"Yes, sir," stammered the unfortunate waitress. "Whatever you like."
What I would like is a medley of shark and swordfish, pan-seared on a bed of vegetables and new potatoes. And to drink? Spring water. Irish, if you have it. And no ice, please, as your ice is no doubt made from tap water, which rather defeats the purpose of spring water. The waitress scurried to the kitchen, relieved to escape from the pale youth at table six. She'd seen a vampire movie once. The undead creature had the very same hypnotic stare. Maybe the kid spoke like a grown-up, because he was actually 500 years old. Artemis smiled in anticipation of his meal, unaware of the consternation he'd caused. "You're going to be a big head at the school dances?" Butler commented. "Pardon? That poor girl was almost in tears. It wouldn't hurt you to be nice occasionally." Artemis was surprised. Butler rarely offered opinions on personal matters. "I don't see myself at school dances, Butler."
"Dancing isn't the point. It's all about communication."
"Communication?" scoffed young Master Fowl. "I doubt there's a teenager alive with a vocabulary equal to mine." Butler was about to point out the difference between talking and communicating when the restaurant door opened. A small, tanned man entered, flanked by a veritable giant. John Spyro and his security. Butler bent low to whisper in his charge's ear. "Be careful, Artemis. I know the big one by reputation." Spyro wound through the tables, arms outstretched. He was a middle-aged American, thin as a javelin and barely taller than Artemis himself. In the 80s, shipping had been his thing. In the 90s, he made a killing in stocks and shares. Now, it was communications. He wore his trademark white linen suit, and there was enough jewellery hanging from his wrists and fingers to gold-leaf the Taj Mahal. Artemis rose to greet his associate. "Mr. Spyro, welcome."
"Hey, little Artemis Fowl, how the hell are you?"
Artemis shook the man's hand. His jewellery jangled like a rattlesnake's tail.
"I'm well. Glad you could come."
Spyro took a chair.
"Artemis Fowl calls with a proposition. I would have walked across broken glass to be here."
The bodyguards appraised each other openly. Apart from their bulk, the two were polar opposites. Butler was the epitome of understated efficiency. Black suit, shaven head, as inconspicuous as it was possible to be at almost 7 feet tall. The newcomer had bleached blonde hair, a cut-off T-shirt, and silver pirate rings in both ears. This was not a man who wanted to be forgotten, or ignored.
"Arnold Blunt," said Butler. "I've heard about you."
Blunt took up his position at John Spyro's shoulder.
"Butler, one of the butlers," he said, in a New Zealand drawl. "I hear you guys are the best. That's what I hear. Let's hope we don't have to find out."
Spyro laughed. It sounded like a box of crickets.
"Arnold, please. We're among friends here. This is not a day for threats."
Butler was not so sure. His soldier's sense was buzzing like a nest of hornets at the base of his skull. There was danger here.
"So, my friend, to business," said Spyro,
fixing Artemis with his close-set dark eyes.
"I've been salivating all the way across the Atlantic. What do you got for me?"
Artemis frowned. He'd hoped business could wait until after lunch.
"Wouldn't you like to see a menu?"
"Nope. I don't eat much anymore. Pills and liquids, mostly. Gut problems."
"Very well,"
said Artemis, laying an aluminium briefcase on the table.
"To business, then."
He flipped the case's lid, revealing a red cube, the size of a mini-disc player, nestling in blue foam. Spyro cleaned his spectacles with the tail end of his tie.
"Oh, what am I seeing here, kid?"
Artemis placed the shining box on the table.
"The future, Mr. Spyro. Ahead of schedule."
John Spyro leaned in, taking a good look.
"Looks like a paperweight to me."
Arno Blunt sniggered, his eyes taunting Butler.
"A demonstration, then," said Artemis, picking up the metal box. He pressed a button and the gadget purred into life.
Sections slid back to reveal speakers and a screen.
"Cute," muttered Spyro. "I flew 3,000 miles for a micro-TV.
Artemis nodded.
"A micro-TV, but also a verbally controlled computer. A mobile phone, a diagnostic aid.
This little box can read any information on absolutely any platform, electrical or organic. It can play videos, laserdiscs, DVDs, go online, retrieve email, hack any computer. It can even scan your chest to see how fast your heart's beating. Its battery is good for 2 years, and of course, it's completely wireless. Artemis paused to let it sink in. Spyro's eyes seemed huge behind his spectacles.
You mean this box will render all other technology obsolete? Your computer plants will be worthless.
The American took several deep breaths.
But how?
Artemis flipped the box over. An infrared sensor pulsed gently on the back. This is the secret. An omnisensor. It can read anything you ask it to, and if the source is programmed in, it can piggyback any satellite you choose.
Spyro wagged a finger. But that's illegal, isn't it?
No, no, said Artemis, smiling. There are no laws against something like this. There won't be for at least 2 years after it comes out. Look how long it took to shut down Napster. The American rested his face in his hands. It was too much.
I don't understand. This is years, no, decades ahead of anything we have now. You're nothing but a 13-year-old kid. How did you do it?
Artemis thought for a second. What was he going to say? 16 months ago, Butler took on a lower elements police retrieval squad and confiscated their fairy technology. Then he, Artemis, had taken the components and built this wonderful box. Hardly.
Let's just say I'm a very smart boy, Mr. Spyro.
Spyro's eyes narrowed.
Maybe you're not as smart as you like us to think. I want a demonstration.
Fair enough, Artemis nodded. Do you have a mobile phone?
Naturally.
Spyro placed his mobile phone on the table. It was the latest Vision Chips model.
Secure, I take it.
Spyro nodded arrogantly. 500-bit encryption. Best in its class. You're not getting into the Fission 400 without a code.
We shall see.
Artemis pointed the sensor at the handset. The screen instantly displayed an image of the mobile phone's workings.
Download?
Inquired a metallic voice from the speaker.
Confirm.
In less than a second, the job was done.
Download complete,
said the box with a hint of smugness. Spyro was aghast.
I don't believe it. That system cost $20 million.
Worthless, said Artemis, showing him the screen.
Would you like to call home, or maybe move some funds around?
You really shouldn't keep your bank account on a SIM card. The American thought for several moments.
That's a trick, he pronounced finally. You must have known about my phone. Somehow, don't ask me how, you got access to it earlier.
That is logical, admitted Artemis. It's what I would suspect. Name your test. Spyro cast his eyes around the restaurant, fingers drumming the tabletop.
Over there,
he said finally, pointing to a video shelf above the bar. Play one of those tapes.
That's it?
It'll do, for a start. Arno Blunt made a huge show of flicking through the tapes, eventually selecting one without a label. He slapped it down on the table, bouncing the engraved silver cutlery half an inch into the air. Artemis resisted the urge to roll his eyes and placed the red box directly onto the tape's surface. An image of the cassette's innards appeared on the tiny plasma screen.
Download?
Asked the box. Artemis nodded.
Download, compensate, and play.
Again, the operation was completed in under a second. An old episode of an English soap crackled into life.
DVD quality, commented Artemis, regardless of the input.
The C-cube will compensate.
The what?
C-cube, repeated Artemis. The name I have given my little box. A tad obvious, I admit, but appropriate. The cube that sees everything. Spyro snatched the videocassette.
Check it,
he ordered, tossing the tape to Arno Blunt.
The bleached blonde bodyguard activated the bar's TV, sliding the video into its slot. Coronation Street flickered across the screen. The same show. Nowhere near the same quality.
Convinced? Asked Artemis. The American tinkered with one of his many bracelets.
Almost. One last test. I have a feeling that the government are monitoring me.
Did you check it out? Artemis thought for a moment. Then he held the multi-sensor close to his mouth.
Cube. Do
Do you read any surveillance beams concentrated on this building?
The machine whirred for a moment. The strongest ion beam is 80 kilometers due west, emanating from U.S. satellite code number ST1132P, registered to the Central Intelligence Agency, estimated time of arrival, 8 minutes. There are also several LEP probes connected to... Artemis hit the mute button before the cube could continue. Obviously, the computer's fairy components could pick up lower elements technology too. He would have to remedy that. In the wrong hands, that information would be devastating to fairy security.
What's the matter, kid? The box was still talking. Who are the LEP?
Artemis shrugged. No pay, no play, as you Americans say. One example is enough. The CIA, no less.
The CIA, breathed Spyro. They suspect me of selling military secrets. They've pulled one of their birds out of orbit just to track me.
Or perhaps me, noted Artemis.
Perhaps you, agreed Spyro. You're looking more dangerous by the second.
Arno Blunt chuckled derisively. Butler ignored it. One of them had to be professional.
Spyro cracked his knuckles, a habit Artemis detested. We got 8 minutes, so let's get down to the nitty-gritty, kid. How much for the box?
Artemis was not paying attention, distracted by the LEP information that the cube had almost revealed. In a careless moment, he had nearly exposed his subterranean friends to exactly the kind of man who would exploit them.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I said, how much for the box?
Firstly, it's a cube, corrected Artemis. And secondly, it's not for sale.
John Spyro took a deep, shuddering breath. Not for sale. You brought me across the Atlantic to show me something you're not gonna sell me? What's going on here?
Butler wrapped his fingers around the handle of his pistol in his waistband. Arno Blunt's hand disappeared behind his back. The tension cranked up another notch.
Artemis steepled his fingers. Mr. Spyro, John, I'm not a complete idiot. I realize the value of my cube. There is not enough money in the world to pay for this particular item. Whatever you could give me, it'd be worth 1,000% more in a week.
So what's the deal, Fowl? Asked Spyro through gritted teeth. What are you offering?
I'm offering you 12 months, for the right price. I'm prepared to keep my cube off the market for a year.
John Spyro toyed with his ID bracelet, a birthday present to himself.
You'll suppress the technology for a year.
Correct. That should give you ample time to sell your stocks before they crash, and to use the profits to buy into Fowl Industries.
There is no Fowl Industries.
Artemis smirked. There will be. Butler squeezed his employer's shoulder. It was not a good idea to bait a man like John Spyro. But Spyro hadn't even noticed the jibe. He was too busy calculating, twisting his bracelet like a string of worry beads.
Your price? He asked eventually.
Gold. 1 metric ton, replied the heir to the Fowl estate.
That's a lot of gold.
Artemis shrugged.
I like gold.
It holds its value. And anyway, it's a pittance compared to what this deal will save you. Spyro thought about it. At his shoulder, Arno Blunt continued staring at Butler. The Fowl bodyguard blinked freely. In the event of confrontation, dry eyeballs would only lessen his advantage. Staring matches were for amateurs.
Let's say I don't like your terms, said John Spyro. Let's say I decide to take your little gadget with me, right now.
Arno Blunt's chest puffed out another centimetre.
Even if you could take the cube, said Artemis, smiling, it would be of little use to you. The technology is beyond anything your engineers have ever seen.
Spyro gave a thin, mirthless smile.
Oh, I'm sure they could figure it out. Even if it took a couple of years, it won't matter to you. Not where you're going.
If I go anywhere, then the C-Cube secrets go with me. Its every function is coded to my voice patterns. It's quite a clever code.
Butler bent his knees slightly, ready to spring.
I bet we could break that code. I got one hell of a team assembled in Fish and Chips.
Pardon me if I'm unimpressed by your one hell of a team, said Artemis. Thus far you've been trailing several years behind Phonetics. Spyro jumped to his feet. He did not like the P word. Phonetics were the only communications company whose stock was higher than fish and chips. Okay, kid, you've had your fun. Now it's my turn. I have to go, before the satellite beam gets here. But I'm leaving Mr. Blunt behind. He patted his bodyguard on the shoulder. You know what you have to do.
Blunt nodded.
He knew. He was looking forward to it. For the first time since the meeting began, Artemis forgot about his lunch and concentrated completely on the situation at hand. This was not going according to plan.
Mr. Spyro, you cannot be serious. We are in a public place, surrounded by civilians. Your man cannot hope to compete with Butler. If you persist with these ludicrous threats, I will be forced to withdraw my offer and will release the C-Cube immediately.
Spyro placed his palms on the table.
Listen, kid, he whispered. I like you. In a couple of years, you could have been just like me. But did you ever put a gun to somebody's head and pull the trigger?
Artemis didn't reply.
No, grunted Spyro. I didn't think so. Sometimes that's all it takes. Guts.
And you don't have them. Artemis was at a loss for words, something that had only happened twice since his fifth birthday. Butler stepped in to fill the silence. Unveiled threats were more his area.
Mr. Spyro, don't try to bluff us. Blunt may be big, but I can snap him like a twig. Then there's nobody between me and you. And take my word for it, you don't want that.
Spyro's smile spread across his nicotine-stained teeth like a smear of treacle.
Oh, I wouldn't say there's nobody between us.
Butler got that sinking feeling. The one you get when there are a dozen laser sights playing across your chest.
They had been set up. Somehow, Spyro had outmaneuvered Artemis.
Hey, foul, said the American. I wonder how come your lunch is taking so long.
It was at that moment Artemis realized just how much trouble they were in.
It all happened in a heartbeat. Spyro clicked his fingers, and every single customer in Enfer drew a weapon from his or her coat. The 80-year-old lady suddenly looked a lot more threatening with a revolver in her bony fist. Two armed waiters emerged from the kitchen wielding folding stock machine guns. Butler never even had time to draw breath. Spyro tipped over the salt cellar.
Check and mate.
My game, kid.
Artemis tried to concentrate. There must be a way out. There was always a way out. But it wouldn't come. He had been hoodwinked, perhaps fatally. No human had ever outsmarted Artemis Fowl. Then again, it only had to happen once.
I'm going now, continued Spyro, pocketing the C-Cube, before that satellite beam shows up and those other ones. The LEP, I've never heard of that particular agency. As soon as I get this gizmo working, they're going to wish they never heard of me.
It's been fun doing business with you.
On the way to the door, Spyro winked at his bodyguard.
You got 6 minutes, Arno. A dream come true, huh? You get to be the guy who took out the great butler.
He turned back to Artemis, unable to resist a final jibe.
Oh, and by the way, Artemis. Isn't that a girl's name?
And he was gone, into the multicultural throngs of tourists on the high street. The old lady locked the door behind him. The click echoed around the restaurant. Artemis decided to take the initiative.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, he said, trying to avoid staring down the black-eyed gun barrels, I'm sure we can come to an arrangement.
Quiet, Artemis! It took a moment for Artemis's brain to process the fact that Butler had ordered him to be silent. Most impertinently, in fact.
I beg your pardon?
Butler clapped a hand over his employer's mouth.
Quiet, Artemis. These people are professionals, not to be bargained with.
Blunt rotated his skull, cracking the tendons in his neck.
You got that right, Butler. We're here to kill you. As soon as Mr. Spyro got the call, we started sending people in. I can't believe you fell for it, man. You must be getting old.
Butler couldn't believe it either. There was a time when he would have staked out any rendezvous site for a week before giving it the thumbs up. Maybe he was getting old. But there was an excellent chance he wouldn't be getting any older.
Okay, Blunt, said Butler, stretching out his empty palms before him. You and me. One on one.
Very noble, said Blunt.
That's your Asian code of honour, I suppose.
Me? I don't have a code.
If you think I'm going to risk you somehow getting out of here, you're crazy. This is an uncomplicated deal. I shoot, you die.
No face-off. No deal.
Blunt reached lazily into his waistband.
Why hurry? One move from Butler, and a dozen bullets would find their mark.
Artemis's brain seemed to have shut down. The usual stream of ideas had dried up.
I'm going to die, he thought. I don't believe it.
Butler was saying something. Artemis decided he should listen.
Richard of York gave battle in vain,
said the bodyguard, enunciating clearly. Blunt was screwing a silencer onto the muzzle of his ceramic pistol.
What are you saying? What kind of gibberish is that? Don't say the great butler's cracking up. Wait till I tell the guys.
But the old woman looked thoughtful.
Richard of York. I know that.
Artemis knew it too. It was virtually the entire verbal detonation code for the fairy Sonic's grenade magnetized to the underside of the table. One of Butler's little security devices. All they needed was one more word, and the grenade would explode, sending a solid wall of sound charging through the building, blowing out every window and eardrum. There would be no smoke or flames, but anyone within a 10-meter radius not wearing earplugs had about 5 seconds before severe pain set in. One more word. The old lady scratched her head with the revolver's barrel.
Richard of York. I remember now, the nuns taught us that in school. Richard of York gave battle in vain. It's one of those memory tricks, the colours of the rainbow.
Rainbow. The final word. Artemis remembered, just in time, to slacken his jaw. If his teeth were clenched, the sonic waves would shatter them like sugar glass. The grenade detonated in a blast of compressed sound, instantaneously hurling 11 people to the furthest extremities of the room until they came into contact with various walls. The lucky ones hit partitions and went straight through. The unlucky ones collided with cavity block walls. Things broke. Not the blocks. Artemis was safe in Butler's bear hug. The bodyguard had anchored himself against a solid doorframe, folding the flying boy into his arms. And they had several other advantages over Spyro's assassins. Their teeth were intact. They did not suffer from any compound fractures, and the sonic filter sponges had sealed, saving their eardrums from perforation. Butler surveyed the room. The assassins were all down, clutching their ears. They wouldn't be uncrossing their eyes for several days. The manservant drew his Sig Sauer pistol from a shoulder holster.
"Stay here," he commanded. "I'm going to check the kitchen."
Artemis settled back into his chair, drawing several shaky breaths. All around was a chaos of dust and moans. But once again, Butler had saved them. All was not lost. It was even possible that they could catch Spyro before he left the country. Butler had a contact in Heathrow security, Sid Commons, an ex-Green Beret he'd served with on bodyguard duty in Monte Carlo. A large figure came into view, blocking out the sunlight. It was Butler, returning from his reconnoiter. Artemis breathed deeply, feeling uncharacteristically emotional.
"Butler," he began. "We really must talk regarding your salary."
But it wasn't Butler. It was Arno Blunt. He had something in each hand. On his left palm, two tiny cones of yellow foam.
"Earplugs," he spat through broken teeth. "I always wear them before a firefight. Good thing too, eh?"
In his right hand, Blunt held a silenced pistol.
"You first," he said, "then the ape."
Arno Blunt cocked the gun, took aim briefly, and fired.
Chapter 2. Lockdown. Haven City. The Lower Elements.
Though Artemis did not intend it, the cube's scan for surveillance beams was to have far-reaching repercussions. The search parameters were so vague that the cube sent probes into deep space and, of course, deep underground. Below the surface, the Lower Elements police were stretched to their limits following the recent Goblin Revolution. 3 months after the attempted Goblin takeover, most of the major players were in custody. But there were still isolated pockets of the Bois Kell Triad loping around Haven's tunnels with illegal soft-nose lasers. Every available LEP officer had been drafted in to help with Operation Mop-Up, before the tourist season got started. The last thing the city council wanted was tourists spending their leisure gold in Atlantis, because Haven's pedestrianized central plaza was not safe to wander through. Tourism, after all, accounted for 18% of the capital's revenue. Captain Holly Short was on loan from the reconnaissance squad. Generally, her job was to fly to the surface on the trail of fairies, who had ventured above ground without a visa. If even one renegade fairy got himself captured by the mud people, then Haven ceased to be a haven. So, until every gang goblin was licking his eyeballs in Howler's Peak Correctional Facility, Holly's duties were the same as every other LEP officer. Rapid response to any Bois Kell alert. Today, she was escorting four rowdy goblin hoods to Police Plaza for processing. They had been found asleep in an insect delicatessen, stomachs distended after a night of gluttony. It was lucky for them that Holly had arrived when she did, because the deli's dwarf owner was on the point of lowering the scaly foursome into the deep fat fryer. Holly's ride-along for Operation Mop-Up was Corporal Grub Kelp, little brother to the famous Captain Trouble Kelp, one of the LEP's most decorated officers. Grub, however, did not share his brother's stoic personality.
"I've got a hangnail cuffing that last goblin,"
said the junior officer, chewing on his thumb. "Painful," said Holly, trying to sound interested. They were driving along a Magna strip to Police Plaza, with the perpetrators manacled in the rear of their LEP wagon. It wasn't actually a regulation wagon. The Bois Kell had managed to burn out so many police vehicles during their short-lived revolution that the LEP had been forced to commandeer anything with an engine and room in the back for a few prisoners. In reality, Holly was piloting a curry van with the LEP acorn symbol spray-painted on the side. The motor pool gnomes had simply bolted the serving hatch and removed the ovens. A pity they couldn't remove the smell. Grub studied his wounded finger.
"Those cuffs have sharp edges. I should lodge a complaint."
Holly concentrated on the road, though the Magna strip did the steering for her. If Grub did lodge a complaint, it wouldn't be his first, or even his 20th. Trouble's little brother found fault with everything, except himself. In this instance, he was completely wrong. There were no sharp edges on the Perspex vacuum cuffs. If there had been, a goblin might think to poke a hole in the other mitt and allow oxygen to reach his hand, and nobody wanted goblins hurling fireballs in the back of their vehicles.
"I know it sounds a bit petty to lodge a complaint over hangnails, but no one could accuse me of being petty."
"You? Petty?"
"Perish the thought." Grub puffed up his chest.
"After all, I'm the only member of LEP Retrieval 1 to have faced down the human butler."
Holly groaned loudly. This, she fervently hoped, would dissuade Grub from telling his Artemis Fowl war story yet again. It grew longer and more fantastical each time. In reality, Butler had let him go, as a fisherman would a minnow. But Grub was not about to take a hint.
"I remember it well," he began melodramatically. "It was a dark night."
And, as though his very words carried immeasurable magic, every light in the city went out. Not only that, but the Magna strip's power failed, leaving them stranded in the middle lane of a frozen highway.
"I didn't do that, did I?" whispered Grub.
Holly didn't answer, already halfway out of the wagon door. Overhead, the sun strips that replicated surface light were fading to black. In the last moments of half-light, Holly squinted towards the northern tunnel, and, sure enough, the door was sliding down. Emergency lights revolving along its lower edge. 60 meters of solid steel separating Haven from the outside world. Similar doors were dropping at strategic arches all over the city. Lockdown. There were only 3 reasons that the council would initiate a city-wide lockdown. Flood, quarantine, or discovery by the humans. Holly looked around her. Nobody was drowning. Nobody was sick. So, the mud people were coming. Finally, every fairy's worst nightmare was coming true. Emergency lights flickered on overhead, the sunstrip's soft white glow replaced by an eerie orange. Official vehicles would receive a burst of power from the Magna strip, enough to get them to the nearest depot. Ordinary citizens were not so lucky. They would have to walk. Hundreds stumbled from their automobiles, too scared to protest. That would come later.
Captain Shaw! Holly!
It was Grubb. No doubt he would be lodging a complaint with someone.
Corporal, she said, turning back to the vehicle, this is no time for panic. We need to set an example.
The lecture petered out in her throat when she saw what was happening to the wagon. All LEP vehicles would have by now received the regulation 10-minute burst of power from the Magnestrip to get them and their cargo to safety. This power would also keep the Perspex cuffs vacuumed. Of course, as they weren't using an official LEP vehicle, they hadn't been cleared for emergency power. Something the goblins obviously realized, because they were trying to burn their way out of the wagon. Grubb stumbled from the cab, his helmet blackened by soot.
They've melted the cuffs off and started blasting the doors,
he panted, retreating to a safe distance. Goblins. Evolution's little joke. Pick the dumbest creatures on the planet and give them the ability to conjure fire. If the goblins didn't stop blasting the wagon's reinforced interior, they would soon be encased in molten metal. Not a nice way to go, even if you were fireproof. Holly activated the amplifier in her LEP helmet.
You there, in the wagon, cease fire. The vehicle will collapse and you will be trapped.
For several moments, smoke billowed from the vents. Then the vehicle settled on its axles. A face appeared at the grill, fork-tongued, slithering through the mesh.
You think we're stupid, Elf? We're going to burn clean through this pile of junk.
Holly stepped closer, turning up the speakers.
Listen to me, Goblin. You are stupid. Let's just accept that and move on. If you continue to fireball that vehicle, the roof will melt and fall on you like shells from a human gun. You may be fireproof, but are you bulletproof?
The goblin licked his lidless eyes, thinking it over.
You lie, Elf! We will blow a hole right through this prison! You will be next!
The wagon's panels began to lurch and buckle as the goblins renewed their attack.
Not to worry, said Grubb from a safe distance. The fire extinguishers will get them.
They would, corrected Holly, if the fire extinguishers weren't connected to the main power grid, which is shut down. A mobile food preparation wagon, such as this one, would have to adhere to the strictest fire regulations before setting one magna wheel on the strip. In this case, several foam-packed extinguishers, which could submerge the entire interior in flame-retardant foam in a matter of seconds. The nice thing about the flame foam was that it hardened on contact with air. But the not-so-nice thing about the flame foam was that the trip switch was connected to the magna strip. No power, no foam. Holly drew her Neutrino 2000 from its holster.
I'll just have to trip the switch myself.
Captain Short sealed her helmet and climbed into the wagon's cab. She avoided touching metal wherever possible, because even though microfilaments in her LEP jumpsuit were designed to disperse extra heat, microfilaments didn't always do what they were designed to do. The goblins were on their backs, pumping fireball after fireball into the roof panels.
Knock it off!
She ordered, pointing her laser's muzzle through the mesh. Three of the goblins ignored her. One, possibly the leader, turned his scaly face to the grill. Holly saw that he had eyeball tattoos. This act of supreme stupidity probably would have guaranteed him promotion, had the Bois Kel not been effectively disbanded.
You will not be able to get us all, Elf,
he said, smoke leaking from his mouth and slitted nostrils.
Then one of us will get you!
The goblin was right, even if he didn't realize why. Holly suddenly remembered that she could not fire during a lockdown. Regulations stated that there were to be no unshielded power surges in case Haven were being probed. Her hesitation was all the proof the goblin needed.
I knew it!
He crowed, tossing a casual fireball at the grill. The mesh glowed red and sparks cascaded against Holly's visor. Over the goblins' heads, the roof sagged dangerously. A few more seconds and it would collapse. Holly unclipped a Python dart from her belt, screwing it into the launcher above the Neutrino's main barrel. The launcher was spring-loaded, like an old-fashioned spear gun, and would not give off a heat flash, nothing to alarm any sensors. The goblin was highly amused, as goblins often are just before incarceration, which explains why so many are incarcerated.
A dart! You're going to prod us all to death, little elf!
Polly aimed at a clip protruding from the fire foam nozzle in the rear of the wagon.
Would you please be quiet?
She said, and launched the dart. It flew over the goblin's head, jamming itself between the rods of the nozzle clip. The python cord stretched the length of the wagon.
Miss me,
said the goblin, wagging his forked tongue. It was a testament to the goblin's stupidity that he could be trapped in a melting vehicle during a lockdown with an LEP officer firing at him and still think he had the upper hand.
I told you to be quiet,
said Holly, pulling sharply on the python cord and snapping the clip. 800 kilograms of extinguisher foam blasted from the diffuser nozzle at over 200 miles per hour. Needless to say, all fireballs went out. The goblins were pinned down by the force of the already hardening foam. The leader was pressed so forcibly against the grill that his tattooed eyes were easily legible. One said, Mummy, and the other, Duddy. A misspelling, though he probably didn't know it.
Ow!
He said, more from disbelief than pain. He didn't say anything else, because his mouth was full of congealing foam.
Don't worry, said Holly.
The foam is porous, so you'll be able to breathe. But it's also completely fireproof, so good luck trying to burn your way out. Grub was still examining his hangnail when Holly emerged from the van. She removed her helmet, wiping the soot from the visor with the sleeve of her jumpsuit. It was supposed to be non-stick. Maybe she should send it in for another coating.
Everything all right?
Asked Grub. Yes, Corporal, everything is all right, no thanks to you. Grub had the audacity to look offended.
I was securing the perimeter, Captain. We can't all be action heroes.
That was typical Grub, an excuse for every occasion. She could deal with him later. Now it was vital that she get to Police Plaza and find out why the council had shut down the city.
I think we should get back to HQ,
Grub offered. The intelligence boys might want to interview me if the humans are invading. I think I should get back to HQ, said Holly. You stay here and keep an eye on the suspects until the power comes back on. Do you think you can handle that? Or are you too incapacitated with that hangnail? Holly's auburn hair stood in sweat-slicked spikes, and her round hazel eyes dared Grub to argue.
No, Holly. Captain, you leave it to me. Everything is under control.
I doubt it, thought Holly, setting off at a run towards Police Plaza. The city was in complete chaos. Every citizen was on the street, staring at his or her dead appliance in disbelief. For some of the younger fairies, the loss of their mobile phones was too much to bear. They sank to the street, sobbing gently. Police Plaza was mobbed by inquiring minds, like moths drawn to a light. In this case, one of the only lights in town. Hospitals and emergency vehicles would still have juice, but otherwise the LEP headquarters was the only government building still functioning. Holly forced her way through the crowd into the lobby area. The public service queues ran down the steps and out the door. Today, everyone was asking the same question, what's happened to the power? The same question was on Holly's lips as she burst into the situations booth, but she kept it to herself. The room was already packed with the force's complement of captains, along with 3 regional commanders and all 7 council members.
Ah, said Carteres, the last captain.
I didn't get my emergency juice, explained Holly. Non-regulation vehicle. Carteres adjusted his official conical hat.
No time for excuses, Captain. Mr. Foley has been holding off his briefing until you got here.
Holly took her seat at the captain's table, beside Trouble Kelp.
Grab, okay, he whispered.
He got a hangnail.
Trouble rolled his eyes. No doubt he'll make a complaint.
The centaur, Foley, trotted through the doors, clutching armfuls of discs. Foley was the LEP's technical genius, and his security innovations were the main reason that humans had not yet discovered the subterranean fairy hideaway. Maybe that was about to change. The centaur expertly loaded the discs onto the operating system, opening several windows on a wall-sized plasma screen. Several complicated-looking algorithms and wave patterns appeared on the screen. He cleared his throat noisily.
I advise Chairman Carteres to initiate lockdown on the basis of these readings.
Recon's Commander Root sucked on an unlit fungus cigar,
I think I'm speaking for the whole room here, Foley, when I say that all I see is lines and squiggles. Doubtless it makes sense to a smart pony like yourself, but the rest of us are going to need some plain gnomish.
Foley sighed. Well, simply put, really simply, we got pinged.
Is that plain enough?
It was. The room resonated with stunned silence. Pinged was an old naval term from back in the days when sonar was the preferred method of detection. Getting pinged was slang for being detected. Someone knew the fairy folk were down there. Root was the first to recover his voice.
Pinged? Who pinged us?
Foley shrugged. Dunno. It only lasted a few seconds. There was no recognizable signature. And it was untraceable.
What did they get?
Quite a bit. Everything North European. Scopes, Sentinel, all our cam-cams, downloaded information on every one of them. This was catastrophic news. Someone, or something, knew all about fairy surveillance in Northern Europe after only a few seconds.
Or was it human? Asked Holly. Or alien?
Foley pointed to a digital representation of the beam. I can't say for certain. If it is human, it's something brand new. This came out of nowhere. No one has been developing technology like this, as far as I know. Whatever it is, it read us like an open book. My security encryptions folded like they weren't even there.
Carteret took off his official hat, no longer concerned with protocol.
What does this mean for the people?
It's difficult to say. There are best and worst case scenarios. Our mysterious guest could learn all about us whenever he wishes, and do with our civilization what he will.
And the best case scenario?
Asked Trouble. Foley took a breath. That was the best case scenario. Commander Root called Holly into his office. The room stank of cigar smoke in spite of the purifier built into the desk. Foley was already there, his fingers a blur over the commander's keyboard.
The signal originated in London somewhere, said the Centaur. We only know that because I happened to be looking at the monitor at the time.
He leaned back from the keyboard, shaking his head.
This is incredible. It's some kind of hybrid technology, almost like our ion system, but not quite. Just a hair's breadth away.
The how is not important now, said Root. It's the who I'm worried about.
What can I do, sir? Asked Holly.
Root stood and walked to a map of London on the wall plasma screen.
I need you to sign out a surveillance pack, go topside and wait. If we get pinged again, I want someone on site, ready to go. We can't record this thing, but we can certainly get a visual on the signal. As soon as it shows up on the screen, we'll feed you the coordinates, and you can investigate.
Holly nodded. When is the next hotshot? Hotshot was LEP speak for the magna flares that recon officers ride to the surface in titanium eggs. Pod pilots referred to this seat-of-the-pants procedure as riding the hotshots.
No such luck, replied Foley. Nothing in the pipes for the next 2 days. You'll have to take a shuttle.
What about the lockdown?
I restored power to Stonehenge and our satellite arrays. We'll have to risk it. You need to get above ground and we need to stay in contact. The future of our civilization could depend on it.
Holly felt the weight of responsibility settle on her shoulders. This future of our civilization thing was happening more and more lately.
Chapter 3 On Ice. Enfin, Knightsbridge. The sonic blast from Butler's grenade had crashed through the kitchen door, sweeping aside stainless steel implements like stalks of grass. The aquarium had shattered, leaving the flagstones slick with water, perspex, and surprised lobsters. They skittered through the debris, claws raised. The restaurant staff were on the floor, bound and saturated, but alive. Butler did not untie them. He did not need hysteria right now. Time enough to deal with them once all threats had been neutralized. An assassin stirred, suspended halfway through a dividing wall. The manservant checked her eyes. They were crossed and unfocused. No threat there. Butler pocketed the old lady's weapon just the same. You couldn't be too careful. Something he was learning all over again.
If Madame Co. had seen this afternoon's display, she would have had his graduation tattoo lasered for sure. The room was clear, but still something was bothering the bodyguard. His soldier's sense grated like two broken bones. Once again, Butler flashed back to Madame Co., his sensei from the academy.
The bodyguard's primary function is to protect his principal. The principal cannot be shot if you are standing in front of him.
Madame Co. always referred to employers as principals. One did not become involved with principals. Butler wondered why this particular maxim had occurred to him. Out of the hundreds Madame Co. had drummed into his skull, why this one? It was obvious, really. He had broken the first rule of personal protection by leaving his principal unguarded. The second rule,
do not develop an emotional attachment to the principal,
was pretty much in smithereens, too. Butler had become so attached to Artemis that it was obviously beginning to affect his judgment. He could see Madame Co. before him, nondescript in her khaki suit, for all the world like an ordinary Japanese housewife. But how many housewives of any nationality could strike so quickly that the air hissed?
You are a disgrace, Butler. A disgrace to your name. It would better suit your talents to get a job mending shoes. Your principal has already been neutralized.
Butler moved as though in a dream. The very air seemed to hold him back as he raced for the kitchen doors. He knew what would have happened. Arno Blunt was a professional, vain perhaps, a cardinal sin among bodyguards, but a professional nonetheless. Professionals always inserted earplugs if there was any danger of gunfire. The tiles were slick beneath his feet, but Butler compensated by leaning forward and digging his rubber-soled toes into the surface. His intact eardrums picked up irregular vibrations from the restaurant. Conversation. Artemis was speaking with someone. Arno Blunt, no doubt. It was already too late. Butler came through the service door at a speed that would have shamed an Olympian. His brain began calculating odds the moment pictures arrived from his retinas. Blunt was in the act of firing. Nothing could be done about that now. There was only one option. Without hesitation, Butler took it. In his right hand, Blunt held a silenced pistol.
You first, he said. Then the ape.
Arno Blunt cocked the gun, took aim briefly, and fired. Butler came from nowhere. He seemed to fill the entire room, flinging himself in the bullet's path. From a greater distance, the Kevlar in his bulletproof vest might have held, but at point-blank range, the Teflon-coated bullet drilled through the waistcoat like a hot poker through snow. It entered Butler's chest a centimetre below the heart. It was a fatal wound. And this time Captain Short was not around to save him with her fairy magic. The bodyguard's own momentum, combined with the force of the bullet, sent Butler crashing into Artemis, pinning him to the dessert trolley. Nothing of the boy was visible, save one Armani loafer. Butler's breathing was shallow and his vision gone, but he was not dead yet. His brain's electricity was rapidly running out, but the bodyguard held on to a single thought, protect the principal. Arno Blunt drew a surprised breath, and Butler fired six shots at the sound. He would have been disappointed with the spread had he been able to see it, but one of the bullets found its mark, clipping Blunt's temple. Unconsciousness was immediate. Concussion inevitable. Arno Blunt joined the rest of his team on the floor. Butler ignored the pain squashing his torso like a giant fist. Instead, he listened for movement. There was nothing locally, just the scratch of lobster claws on the tiles, and if one of the lobsters decided to attack, Artemis was on his own. Nothing more could be done. Either Artemis was safe, or he was not. If not, Butler was in no condition to fulfill the terms of his contract. This realization brought tremendous calm. No more responsibility. Just his own life to live. For a few seconds, at any rate. And anyway, Artemis wasn't just a principal. He was part of the bodyguard's life. His only true friend. Madame Co. may not have liked this attitude, but there wasn't much she could do about it now. There wasn't much anybody could do. Artemis never liked desserts, and yet he found himself submersed in eclairs, cheesecake and pavlova. His suit would be absolutely destroyed. Of course, Artemis's brain was only throwing up these facts so that he could avoid thinking about what had happened. But a 200-pound deadweight is a hard thing to ignore. Luckily for Artemis, Butler's impact had actually driven him through to the trolley's second shelf, while the bodyguard remained on the ice cream ledge above. As far as Artemis could tell, the Black Forest Gatto had cushioned his impact sufficiently to avoid serious internal injury. Still, he had no doubt that a visit to the chiropractor would be called for. Possibly for Butler, too, though the man had the constitution of a troll. Artemis struggled out from underneath his manservant. With each movement, malignant cream horns exploded in his direction.
"Really, Butler," grumbled the teenager, "I must begin choosing my business associates more carefully. Hardly a day goes by when we aren't victims of some plot."
Artemis was relieved to see Arno Blunt unconscious on the restaurant floor.
"Another villain dispatched. Good shooting, Butler, as usual. And one more thing. I've decided to wear a bulletproof vest to all future meetings. That should make your job somewhat easier, eh?"
It was at this point that Artemis noticed Butler's shirt. The sight knocked the air from his chest like an invisible mallet. Not the hole in the material, but the blood leaking from it.
"Butler, you're injured. Shot. But the Kevlar!"
The bodyguard didn't reply, nor did he have to. Artemis knew science better than most nuclear physicists. Truth be told, he often posted lectures on the internet under the pseudonym MC Squire. Obviously, the bullet's momentum had been too great for the jacket to withstand. It had possibly been coated with Teflon for extra penetration. A large part of Artemis wanted to drape his arms across the bodyguard's frame and cry, as he would for a brother. But Artemis repressed that instinct. Now was the time for quick thinking. Butler interrupted his train of thought.
"Artemis, is that you?" he said,
the words coming in short gasps.
"Yes, it's me,"
answered Artemis, his voice trembling.
"Don't worry. Juliet will protect you. You'll be fine."
"Don't talk, Butler. Lie still. The wound is not serious."
Butler spluttered. It was as close as he could get to a laugh.
"Very well, it is serious, but I'll think of something. Just stay still."
With his last vestige of strength, Butler raised a hand.
"Goodbye, Artemis," he said. "My friend."
Artemis caught the hand. The tears were streaming now, unchecked.
"Goodbye, Butler."
The Eurasian's sightless eyes were calm.
"Artemis, call me Domovoy."
The name told Artemis two things. Firstly, his lifelong ally had been named after a Slavic guardian spirit. Secondly, graduates of the Madame Co. Academy were instructed never to reveal first names to their principals. It helped to keep things clinical. Butler would never have broken this rule. Unless it no longer mattered.
"Goodbye, Domovoy,"
sobbed the boy.
"Goodbye, my friend."
The hand dropped. Butler was gone.
"No!"
shouted Artemis, staggering backwards. This wasn't right. This was not the way things should end. For some reason, he had always imagined that they would die together, facing insurmountable odds in some exotic location. On the lip of a reactivated Pompeii, perhaps, or on the banks of the mighty Ganges. But together, as friends. After all they had been through, Butler simply could not be defeated at the hands of some grandstanding second-rate muscle man. Butler had almost died before. Last year he'd been mauled by a troll from the deep tunnels below Haven City. Holly Short had saved him then, using her fairy magic. But now there were no fairies around to save the bodyguard. Time was the enemy here. If Artemis had more of it, he could figure out how to contact the LEP and persuade Holly to use her magic once again. But time was running out. Butler had perhaps 4 minutes before his brain shut down. Not long enough. Even for an intellect such as Artemis's, he needed to buy some more time. Or steal some. Think, boy, think. Use what the situation provides. Artemis shut off the wellspring of tears. He was in a restaurant. A fish restaurant. Useless, worthless. Perhaps in a medical facility, he could do something, but here, what was here? An oven, sinks, utensils. Even if he did have the proper tools, he had not yet completed his medical studies. It was too late for conventional surgery, at any rate, unless there was a method of heart transplant that took less than 4 minutes. The seconds were ticking by. Artemis was growing angry with himself. Time was against them. Time was the enemy. Time needed to be stopped. The idea sparked in Artemis's brain in a flash of neurons. Perhaps he